This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Across the country, journalism and law students team up to investigate cases of prisoners who may have been falsely convicted. The programs are broadly modeled on the Innocence Project, which specializes in DNA technology, but students also pore over court transcripts, conduct new interviews with witnesses, and reconsider other kinds of evidence. And in fact, dozens of convictions have been overturned. Now, a group of students at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Chicago believes they've found proof of the innocence of a man in prison for 3 decades for murder. But in a novel response, the Cook County State's Attorney, Anita Alvarez, is putting the spotlight on the university and the students. She says they've taken on the role of investigators and therefore need to turn over their emails, all the notes they've compiled on the case, and their grades. Is this a far-reaching redefinition of innocence projects or prosecutors trampling the rights of journalists? Later in the program, a deadly bomb kills senior members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard and exposes ethnic and religious splits in the Islamic Republic. But first, the challenge to the Innocent Project. If you've worked for that or a similar project as a student, what records are prosecutors entitled to? We'd also like to hear from criminal prosecutors and defense attorneys. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Constitutional law expert Jonathan Turley joins us here in Studio 3A. He teaches public interest law at George Washington University. Nice to have you back in the program, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
And I have here a copy of the subpoena from the state's attorney. She was not able to appear on the show today. She had other business. But their argument is, quote, "There simply are no exemptions that allow a university to investigate a murder case and then withhold new information it generated at the resulting post-conviction hearing. The law imposes a duty on all citizens to reveal relevant information in criminal matters," end quote. To that end, they've asked for all the notes, memoranda, reports, and summaries created by the students, the professor's notes, instructions, grading criteria, and the syllabus, the students' grades for each quarter they worked on the case, and any emails, payments, audio, or videotapes created as a result of the case. This is a pretty broad subpoena.
Well, it's breathtaking how the scope of this subpoena goes into everything they could possibly get on these students. Now, from the prosecutor's standpoint, they're saying that basically once you throw into play a question of a criminal conviction, the people of the state of Illinois have a right to see all the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And judges may, in fact, be sympathetic with some of the things on the subpoena list, like the first one being notes, memoranda, that might have additional evidence that goes to innocence and whether...
Or guilt, for that matter, because the subpoena also says, certainly justice requires an objective review of all evidence, not simply the evidence the school now feels is supportive of their version of events.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that some judges will, frankly, be sympathetic. They will say, we're trying to find out whether this person is guilty or innocent. You have sent people out there to gather information. We need to know not only what it is that you gathered, but we also have to know something about the investigators. Obviously, the press and free speech advocates view this in a much darker way. I've never personally seen anything quite like this. I don't know of any other case where prosecutors delve this deeply into what were normally viewed as privileged material. Now, the problem is also going to be a test of the Illinois privilege given to reporters.
The shield laws.
The shield law. And most states have shield laws. The federal system actually is behind the ball in that sense. They don't protect reporters the same way. But Section 8902 defines a reporter under the Illinois law. And it defines it as any person regularly engaged in the business of collecting, writing, or editing news for publication. Is that a student? Is a student engaged in the business of collecting and publishing information? I would say yes, because if that's not the case, literally thousands of journalists who are working for excellent newspapers, mm-hmm. college university papers are serious papers that do serious work. But
well, are these materials gathered and published in the student newspaper, or are they just presented to the court?
That's the other problem. That is, even if they can establish that these are student journalists, the question is, what were they doing? Was it journalism, or was it just standard investigation? These students gathered information and gave it to prosecutors, and the prosecutors are saying, you know, we see this all the time. You're called an investigator, and we have a right to see what you have.
And that makes a degree of sense. But nevertheless, the other side is going to say, hey, wait a minute, you're asking for a reporter's notes.
That's right. And it creates an enormous chilling effect. It's positively glacial. You're talking about one of the most successful programs in media and the law, the Innocence Project. You're also talking about prosecutors who, frankly, collectively in this office, failed miserably in these cases. This is a very embarrassing area. These groups of students collectively...
Well, wait, this is 30 years ago. Yes, embarrassing, but the people who are embarrassed are either in Florida or dead, presumably.
True, but prosecutors really reel from these cases. There's 11 cases in Illinois that have been shown to have been in question or invalid. People have had their convictions reversed. That has an embarrassing effect upon prosecutors. It affects juries, and to suffice it to say, many prosecutors are somewhat hostile towards these efforts. And when you look at the subpoena, what free speech advocates see, what free media advocates see, is hostility. What's the purpose?
In other words, if you're going to mess with our office, we're going to mess with your office.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is usually in these cases, you see a fight over a subpoena to get evidence of a crime. This is getting evidence of the motivation to investigate a crime. That's what makes it different. You know, the Supreme Court in a case called Zurcher in 1978 created a very low bar for the searching of a student newspaper. That was the Stanford Daily.
Mm-hmm.
And the court basically said that journalists generally are not given any particular protection from these types of searches. But those were searches looking into crimes. What's different here is they're saying, we want to know what your motivation was to say that we failed to do our work and convicted an innocent man.
The grades, presumably, at least as I read the subpoena, are they want to know, were students given an incentive to come to a certain conclusion that somebody was innocent by getting better grades if they came to that conclusion, they came to the opposite conclusion?
That's right. And I think what the prosecutors will say is that if this wasn't a university, it was an investigator, the first thing we would ask is, who's paying you? What are you getting for this work? And for students, that comes in the form of an academic benefit. But that really treats very lightly the protection that has been normally given academic projects like this. And so you're talking about a request here that seems to go not into whether the evidence is valid, but whether the people who collected it had the best motivations. And I think what these students are saying is, what does that matter? Why don't you talk to our witnesses, look at our videotapes, judge the evidence instead of trying to shoot the messenger?
We're talking with Jonathan Turley, a professor of public interest law at George Washington University and an expert on constitutional law. And we're talking about the Innocence Project and its ilk. If you have worked for one of these projects around the country, give us a call. Tell us about your experience. Or if you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney, we'd like to hear from you as well. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And James is on the line from San Antonio.
Hi, this is James calling from San Antonio. I'm a criminal defense attorney down here. And my inclination in hearing this is absolutely don't force these kids to hand over anything. And my main reason in thinking this is the chilling effect. I have similar situations come up here where I take court appointments on felony cases in three different counties down here, and the district judges don't want to give us any money for investigators, and we end up having to investigate the cases ourselves. Well, what's been happening recently is the Attorney General's office, along with some of the counties here, have been indicting attorneys for tampering with witnesses, you know, quote-unquote tampering with witnesses, because they're out investigating cases themselves because they're not getting any money for investigators to do it. And
Perry Mason never got indicted for that.
Yeah, and so exactly. And you know, it's to me, it's the chilling effect. I mean, we have to look over our shoulders when we're investigating a case. We have to watch out for, you know, if we say the wrong thing to a potential witness, how it may be viewed by the DA's office and the AG's office. And to me, that's just it's unconscionable. I mean, we have to be able to defend our clients. And this is no different.
If in the course of your investigation, James, you ran across a witness who said, the accused, Mr. Jones, I saw him do it, would you be required to turn that over to prosecutors?
Absolutely not. You know, I mean, I you know, obviously I wouldn't be calling him as a witness, but I'm not going to hand him over to the state either, you know?
So that kind of...
Nor should I. I mean, I've got his office to advocate for my client, and that would you know, kind of get in the way of that.
The other side, the prosecution, if they find something that supports your client's case, that's called exculpatory evidence, and they're required to give that over to you, right?
Absolutely, and that Brady v. Maryland. I mean, they have to do that. But you know, there's a little bit of a difference here in the government's role in prosecuting a case. You know, they're supposed to be seeking justice. We're supposed to be zealously advocating for our clients. It's not exactly the same thing. In fact, it's very different.
And so you would see the these Innocence Project type organizations as effectively being on the defense side.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, at a minimum, I mean, look, if they're coming up with information that can help, prove the innocence of somebody, I think that they shouldn't be, you know, hounded into giving up information that could ultimately create a chilling effect to where in the future where somebody who could be in the same situation and exculpatory evidence can be found, well, this could prevent that person from being found innocent because of the chilling effect that's created. And I'm absolutely against the government going in and messing with these kids.
All right, James. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And is that description correct as far as you know, James?
Well, certainly Brady requires the government to turn over information. It is a one-way street. You do have different functions. He's quite right in that. What's different here is that you have a project that's being handled by a journalism school, one of the very best in the world. But there is a question of whether this would have been more protected to be housed in the law school, where they could claim some type of legal privilege, which has always been more robust than a journalistic privilege.
And you'd think that in the law department, the law school, they might say, well, we're only gathering evidence for this guy. We're not required to turn over evidence that might prove his guilt. Nevertheless, journalists are supposed to find the truth, just like the prosecution.
That's right. I actually went to Northwestern Law School, and they have a wonderful clinical program, and they, in fact, would resist any effort to get their privileged documents. Courts are very protective over that. What people don't understand is that the First Amendment puts a huge amount of burden on reporters that protect us in a lot of ways, but it offers few protections to them.
Stay with us, if you would, Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. Coming up, Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project will join us to give us his view. And we'd like to hear from you. If you, as a student, worked on one of these projects, call and tell us what your experience was like. And we'd also like to hear from prosecutors and defense attorneys. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Journalism students at Northwestern University have been looking at the work of police and prosecutors with real results for better than a decade now. It's part of the Medill Innocence Project, but now prosecutors have turned the tables. They subpoenaed the grades, email messages, and much more of the journalism students themselves. We've been talking with Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University, in a moment. Barry Scheck, pioneer of the Innocence Project in New York. We also want to hear from you. If you've worked for a similar project as a student, what records do you think prosecutors are entitled to? We'd also like to hear from criminal prosecutors and defense attorneys. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now from our bureau in New York, Barry Scheck, founder and co-director of the Innocence Project at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law. And nice to have you back on the program today.
Great to be here.
And what exactly do these students do? Are they acting in the role of investigators or are they journalists?
Well, you have to make a distinction first. And I agree, incidentally, with Professor Turley's legal analysis completely. But the Innocence Project that we started at Cardozo Law School and in many other law schools and public defender's offices across the country and private law firms, there are law students that are investigating the case. There are a few Innocence Projects that use journalism students. And the most famous one, the Medill School and Professor David Protess, one of the founders of this whole movement, they're at issue. So first you have to distinguish between law students as part of a legal, you know, services innocence mm-hmm. project and journalism students.
And so journalism students might be considered journalists, but law students certainly would not be.
That's right. And different kinds of privileges attach to both sets of activities. And I don't think there's very much of a question here that David Protess supervises these students and they are engaged in an act of journalism and an act of journalism of the highest order. And, you know, frequently reporters will call prosecutors and they'll say, look, I think you should look into something. Here's some information before they even publish it. Now, that doesn't mean that the prosecutor can turn around and get all their email messages or anything of that nature. And this subpoena is so overbroad that it would have a chilling effect on any Innocence Project, whether it's journalism students or law students. And none of our projects across the country have ever received a subpoena like this before.
No, that's why this is a novel attempt by the Cook County Attorney Prosecutor's Office. But on the basis of fairness, some of their things might be correct. If an Innocence Project, why should we just get, from the prosecutor's point of view, why should we just get your version of events? If you've got other interviews that might support the other side, we'd like to hear those too.
Well, the point is witnesses. And one of the problems here is that sometimes prosecutors, unfortunately, think they own witnesses when, in fact, both sides should have access to witnesses, and even journalists, if the witnesses choose to talk to them, should have access to witnesses. And yes, as I understand it, the tapes that the students made of the witnesses have been made available to the prosecutors. The prosecutors themselves can and should talk to the witnesses. Witnesses can be subpoenaed in court. Arguably, if the issue arises, even the students themselves, with respect to certain conversations that are public, that are part of the tape, that are quoted even in the newspaper, can be questioned about those things. Although, when you start looking at shield laws, those kinds of matters become narrower and narrower. But the idea that you're going to get everybody's email records and the grades of such marginal relevance is overbroad. And then a lot of these things they could get just by going to the website. If they want the syllabus, they can get this by less intrusive means that won't chill investigative activities.
Well, as Professor Turley was suggesting, the grades go to motive, and were the students, did they have an incentive to seek evidence of innocence rather than the truth?
Well, I mean, journalists themselves have an incentive to seek a good story, no matter what. Do we subpoena, their salaries, their evaluations within the newspaper as to whether they're doing a good job or a bad job? Do you get their personnel files? No, unless it's very, very special circumstances. Do we get the prosecutor's personnel file about his or her motivations in bringing a case? Do we get the police officer's personnel file in every case? No. So this subpoena is way out of bounds.
Jonathan Turley, is it normal for a subpoena to be issued saying, asking for the moon, hoping to get a crater or two?
Well, certainly you can get very broad subpoenas like this. Prosecutors are often criticized for not tailoring subpoenas. But when you're in an area of sensitivity like journalism or the clergy, there are policies that you're supposed to balance those needs, look at alternative sources. And what's fascinating is, I was in a case where I asked for motivational evidence of a prosecutor mm-hmm. in a criminal case, and I was met with sheer horror from the prosecutors, who immediately said his motivation's not relevant to the facts in this case. And here you've got prosecutors saying the opposite. It is very relevant. And I think they would have been better off with a degree of adult supervision here in reducing this subpoena. I could see them, for example, asking if money was exchanged. For example, was there any compensation given to these witnesses in any form? That seems a relevant question. But those types of questions are usually handled on a telephone call where the professor says, that's a fair question, and I'll go ahead and I'll answer it in a letter to you.
We should point out again, we did make a request for the Cook County prosecutor to be available to us, or somebody from her office, and they were not able to make anybody available to be on this program with us. So anyway, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. John's on the line from Cleveland.
Yes, I'd like to ask Professor Turley, if this isn't just subjecting defense investigators to the same scrutiny that prosecution's investigators are now subject to under Henthorne and Giglio, where, in fact, defense attorneys are allowed to go fishing through police officers' personnel files.
By quoting Henthorne and Giglio, John, I assume you have some professional expertise?
Yes, I'm a retired federal criminal investigator.
Okay, Jonathan Turley?
Well, I think this goes to the difference of the position between the parties. The burden is on the state to prove guilt. And that's probably one of the most important things that a government does. And so we put a lot of burdens. We require the government to give us information in their possession. It's not a gotcha type of thing. And we do protect the defense files because there is this need to protect the process. The government has many, many advantages. And so I think the answer to that is it's not really this identical position where everyone should get the same type of information because they're not in the same position. And I think that what we have here is something that's hard to imagine why this evidence is relevant. Why does it matter how Laura Brown or Eva Ben
these are two of the students named in the subpoena.
Yeah. What does it matter how Laura did in her fall term? Does that really matter what grade she got? It
matters to her parents.
Yes, it certainly does. But I think that that's the question here. It's not a question of whether some information should have been given, but rather the scope of this. And it does come across as highly antagonistic.
John, you sound like you think this is unfair.
Well, the professor seems to be saying what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander.
Well, I think what he's saying is the prosecution has a lot more power than the defense.
Well, I just know that all of my coworkers thought it unfair when defense attorneys were allowed to root through their personnel files, and it just seems that the subpoena is an attempt to extend the same type of scrutiny to defense investigators, label they put on themselves.
Barry Scheck?
First of all, I think the audience ought to know what Giglio is. Giglio is a case out of the United States Supreme Court which says that when a testifying witness, has been offered a deal by the prosecutor in exchange for their testimony, the state has to turn that over. So I don't think that that is an issue in this case at all. That's clear, and I don't think that's a problem. As far as the personnel files is concerned, you can't just, as a defense lawyer, get access to an investigator's personnel file and go rummaging through them. I don't know of a jurisdiction where that can possibly happen. Before one can even get access to a personnel file, which first ordinarily would be turned over to a judge for what they call in-camera inspection, certain very rigorous kinds of standards have to be met in a case-by-case basis to get access. And as Professor Trilley was indicating at the beginning of the program, sometimes one can get to the files of journalists or get journalists to testify about certain events. But again, the First Amendment requires certain kinds of particularized showing. And I want to add very quickly with respect to defense investigators, if a defense investigator goes out, interviews a witness, and then that witness interview is proffered in court for any particular purpose, the defense is under the same obligations as the prosecutor, what they call reverse discovery, to turn over those statements and does so. So
just with that witness, not every witness.
Not every witness they talk to, but that witness. And finally, I'd like to make a point about innocence projects generally, whether they are part of a legal program or a journalism program. Innocence projects are a little different from a policy point of view because we are investigating cases where individuals have been convicted, and our purpose, even as lawyers, is to find out whether they did it or not. And often try to find out who really committed the crime. And let us not forget that the biggest case the Medill Innocence Project arguably handled was a man named Anthony Porter who came within 2 days of execution, an 18-year-old journalism student, Charm Armbrust, who now is actually teaches at Georgetown Law School and runs her own Innocence Project, went out and found the information showing that another person who had actually been a witness against Porter committed the crime and saved Porter's life and actually led Governor George Ryan to begin to look at other death row convictions, exonerate some others, and give, I think, close to 170 people life in prison instead of potentially the death penalty.
Barry Scheck, how often do innocence projects find that the case is not justified, that in fact the person did do it?
Well, our innocence project at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, we do DNA testing, which is kind of a magic bullet. And we find that in the cases where we get results now, about 40% of the time, the person turns out to have actually committed the crime, or the DNA is unfavorable. 43% of the time, it's exonerating. And I must hasten to add, out of the 200 and I think 44 post-conviction DNA exonerations now, we have found the real perpetrator, identified them 105 times. So this whole enterprise of innocence projects, be they legal or journalistic, I think you have to recognize we're after the truth. We're after seeing whether the person is innocent or guilty. If we come up with proof that they're guilty, generally speaking, the projects drop the cases. They always do. Mm-hmm. And in turn, we often find the real person who committed the crime.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Jonathan Turley?
Well, I agree entirely with what Professor Schreck said, and I think he made a very important distinction between his project and these other projects. These are the most amazing projects we have seen in the legal system since the beginning of the Republic, where these are amazing projects. But I think that what we talk about chilling effect, we should remember that part of the chilling effect here is the one that reporters really worry about, and that is the willingness of people to speak to them. That's, we have to remember that the privilege is not there just as a protection for journalists. It's there to do the work of journalism. And what these students were doing was going to people who could put themselves in legal jeopardy or maybe physical jeopardy. And they were able to at least suggest some privilege, some protection that they could speak to them. They might be willing to speak to them rather than a state's attorney. If Illinois gets its way, you could have a perfectly glacial chilling effect where people will say, yeah, I can talk to you, but you know, the prosecutors can then find out everything I said to you. And that has an impact on what they do.
Let's get another caller on the line, and let's go to Ben. Ben with us from Sacramento, and I understand, Ben, you're a reporter for Capital Public Radio.
I am, and I was also in David Protus's journalism class at Northwestern.
At Northwestern, and actually got a job, so that's good news. But what was that experience like?
It was a really good experience, and I learned a lot in terms of, you know, investigative techniques, in terms of, you know, when you go to, you know, getting documents and talking to people who really don't want to talk to you. You have to try to, you know, you're an outsider going into a community where you really have nothing in common, and you've got to try to convince people to talk about a very sensitive subject. And, you know, you don't always succeed. My group did not succeed in what we were trying to do. It was a case involving a prisoner in Michigan who a black man who had been convicted of shooting a white cop, and it was a very racially sensitive area, the Benton Harbor area of Michigan.
Yes.
And we were not able to come up, you know, we had someone who we thought was an alternate suspect, and we went out to Ohio to talk to him, and the statute of limitations was up, but this person did not obviously say that
spill
he
the
had
beans,
any role
yeah.
in it.
And Neville, did your grades suffer as the result of not getting the goods?
Not to my knowledge. I don't remember exactly what I got, but I got a decent grade. You know, to the extent that the grades might suffer, it might just be simply how hard do you try, and not how hard do you try to find someone who's guilty, but, you know, are you doing your job as a reporter out there? Are you persistent? Are you talking to the people you should be? You know, especially when you're a young journalism student who doesn't necessarily have a lot of full-time experience, you know, you get a little nervous out there. You're out of your element, and a lot of it's just growing up as a reporter, and if you're not able to really just get out there and talk to people, if you are hesitant, and if you don't push, not in the, you know, not push to try find something that's not there, but if you're just sitting there not doing your job, you're not going to get a good grade. But that has nothing to do with, you know, whether the person's guilty or not.
Ben, thanks very much. And I think what you're saying, if I could summarize, we just have a few seconds left, is you didn't detect any incentive to say if you don't find people who are going to be cleared of convictions, you're going to get a D.
That's correct. That never really crossed my mind.
Okay, Ben. And continued good work there at our member station in Sacramento. Appreciate the phone call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Barry Scheck, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Barry Scheck, co-director of the Innocence Project at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York. And we'd also like to thank Jonathan Turley for joining us here in Studio 3A. He's professor of public interest law at George Washington University and an expert on constitutional law. Thanks again.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And we should again remind you, we did invite a representative from the Chicago Public Prosecutor's Office to be with us to discuss their side of this case. They declined to make anybody available on short notice, and we appreciate their efforts to try to provide somebody. In any case, we did make the effort. Coming up, two deadly bombings in southeast Iran expose the danger of ethnic conflicts in that country. Robert Baer will join us to explain next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.